Well, it feels really good to be in a group of people that are reason aficionados, because I just came from a group of people that don't use their brains a whole lot in Congress. I want to talk about labels before I get started, because I just want to take the barometer reading in here. How many people in here self-identify as libertarian? How many? Whoa, that's pretty good. You can answer this in the affirmative as well. How many identify as Republican? Me too. I should have raised my hand the first time. How many identify as Democrat? One, two, three, four, five. What about independent? No affiliation. All right. Well, that's good. You know, everybody tries to label me in Congress, and they have a hard time doing it. I mean, I'm a Republican, but I drive an electric car. I'm not embarrassed to say that. In fact, in Kentucky, you can get Friends of Coal license plates, so that's what's on my electric car. But I live off the grid. Most of my power comes from solar panels. I have a backup generator. I've been off the grid for 10 years. Like I say, a lot of people don't know what to call me. Some people say libertarian. I like constitutional conservative. I've heard Rand Paul use that term. I like that term. Tea Party. The names just start getting worse from there. The label they've given me in Congress that I like the best is that one Republican who never would vote for John Boehner. I have had some party questioning recently. You know, and sometimes it's hard to identify with any of the parties. I've decided I'm not bipartisan, I'm transpartisan. I'm advocating for a transpartisan cloakroom right off. Because I'm not welcome when I walk in either of them. I feel inadequate. So labels are a difficult thing, but they always try to label you. And, when I ran for Congress, I had some examples in front of me. I saw that Rand Paul had won in Kentucky, won a primary against the establishment candidate, who was basically supposed to be, you know, get the rubber stamp. He was preordained to be the next senator from Kentucky, and Rand just smashed him. And then I saw Ron Paul do really well in Iowa and New Hampshire and even Nevada, and I think he ended up with the delegates from five states going to the convention. And then, so I had a prototype to follow, libertarian, Republican. Let's work within the party. So I run, and I did pretty well. And I'm thinking, wow, these libertarian ideas are really catching on within the Republican Party. Then I go to Iowa to help Rand campaign for president. And Trump just, you know, blows everybody away. So I had to do some soul searching, because these were my voters. Like, my voters in Kentucky, the ones that elected me, were voting for Donald Trump. So, you know, what I realize is they're not voting for the libertarian-leaning, you know, Republican ideology. They're voting for the craziest son of a bitch in the race. Like, and I happen to be that, Rand happened to be that, and Ron happened to be that. But he just took it to a whole new level and dropped the ideology, you know. So, but, you know, ideology... Staff is policy in Congress. You know, this is one of the ways they get you when you go into Congress, is they get you to hire bad staff or staff that's working against you or doesn't share your ideals. But the other mistake you can make is to hire all of the same ideology and have 16 people all thinking the same thing. So I have a very diverse staff in Congress. I resolved to hire them across, you know, the ideological spectrum. So half of my staff are Ron Paul people, and the other half are Rand Paul people. We have some wonderful arguments. I mean, we'll argue for hours. And somewhere within that large spectrum of libertarian ideology, we come up with the answer. And so later in my talk here, I'll talk about some ideological issues. Does anybody know about that show House of Cards? Yeah, all right. Has anybody binge-watched House of Cards? Okay. Well, for the folks that haven't watched House of Cards, it's a fictional show. I have to keep reminding my colleagues it's not an instructional video. But It's a fictional show. And I started watching it, and it was, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I just got to Congress, so I think, well, let's watch House of Cards. So I started watching House of Cards, but there's a guy that does cocaine in a trailer park, like a congressman. And then I'm like, that's never gonna happen. Then my buddy from Florida, the fine gentleman from Florida, I won't say his name, gets busted for buying cocaine at Union Station. And then, you know, I see him trading inauguration tickets for votes. And I'm like, why would you trade a vote on an important issue for an inaugural ticket? And then I see it happen. Like, all of these things happen. So I'm like, all right, maybe it is an instructional video. So I start watching it, and I notice there's one thing that just ruins the show for me. I mean, the producers got almost everything right. They used the right chandeliers, the right furniture. You could, if you're a real congressman, when you watch it, you break out in hives and sweats when you watch it. It's so real in that regard, until I saw the big flaw. In House of Cards, there is one man who has a plan. There is nobody in Congress with a plan. You know, not even the bad guys have a plan. If, you know, and Frank Underwood is the bad guy, but he's got a plan, so I kind of admire that as an engineer. You know, I would probably gravitate toward a bad guy with a plan, but there's nobody with a plan. So when people ask me at the town halls, is House of Cards real? Is House of Cards real? If I watch House of Cards, can I find out how Congress works? I say, no, but there's another show on Netflix called The Walking Dead. And if you watch that show, you'll get an idea of what we're dealing with up there. Some people, they said, don't go up there and get Potomac fever. You know, I'm from Kentucky. I grew up in a rural area. By the way, I went to MIT. I'd never even been to Massachusetts, but I decided it was a pretty good school and I would see if I could get accepted. I got accepted. I showed up the week of classes. I'd never even been like north of Pennsylvania in my life. And so I get off the plane. We had one stoplight in the town that I grew up in. And trust me, no crosswalks, no sidewalks. You were on your own. And I'm walking to a crosswalk and a car honked at me. And I thought, wow, I've been here 20 minutes and I already met somebody I know. So I'm waving at him in Boston, Massachusetts. And I'm waving at this person thinking, how wonderful. Yes, how lucky am I? Just right off the plane. And I look down and he's waving back with one finger. And that was my introduction to Boston. But anyways, I got acclimated, invented some technology at MIT, started a company, raised venture capital. By the way, when we raised our first, are there any entrepreneurs in here? I figured there'd be a few. All right. Well, is there anybody that wants to start a company in here? Okay, there are a few, even with Obama in charge. So here's a little advice for you. The first $2 million we raised, I was still a student, my wife is still a student at MIT, and we're raising $2 million of venture capital on a $7 million pre-money valuation. This is like blowing my mind. I've got homework to turn in tomorrow. And we got term sheets to read, you know, and sign. And so we're closing the deal, and they're doing their due diligence, and they said, well, we got to buy key man insurance. And I'm like, nobody ever had life insurance on me. I'm not sure I like this idea. You mean I die and you get all your money back? And that's basically what the key man policy was. So they sent, I'm like, I don't have time to go to the doctor. I'm running a company, and I'm doing problem sets here for school. So they sent a nurse over to draw my blood to see if I had any diseases, you know, like terminal diseases, or maybe do I do drugs? Like, they wanted to know all these things. So I look down, and I'm in my office. The nurse is drawing my blood. I see it filling up in the vial, and I said, my God, they really are blood-sucking venture capitalists. So I do know a little bit about capitalism, but... Anyways, that's my background. That's why they don't know what to make of me in Congress. I do remember at MIT, John Sununu came and spoke when I was a student. And I was like, wow, a Republican on campus. So I went to listen to what he had to say. And one of the things that stuck with me is he said, we need more engineers and fewer lawyers in Congress. He said, and Hey, there you go. Here's the lawyers are trained to accept a position. They're given a position to defend and then go find facts to support that position. These are, if there are any lawyers in here, these are John Sununu's words, not mine. Whereas an engineer or in a doctor's case, or a scientist's case, we're trained to collect the facts and then come up with the conclusion, instead of starting with the conclusion and going and trying to find facts to make the conclusion real. So that, I guess that stuck with me. And I had this sort of quaint notion that an engineer could make a difference in Congress. I think there are places we can make a difference, but so much of Congress just runs on intuition and interpersonal, you know, relationships that is sometimes it's frustrating for a congressman. I thought you could design a voting algorithm, right? And I could code this in C++, and I would take ideology and then constituent constraints and, you know, all these other things, and out would pop yay or nay. And then I noticed I'm working with a bunch of colleagues who are like ambulatory bipedal mammals that have chemical reactions going on in their brains, and you can never predict what button they're going to press. So it has been frustrating in that regard, being in Congress. Washington, you know, when Rand and I were in Iowa, and I was like the warm-up act for Rand, he talked about something over and over and over, which is so true, and it's Washington's dirty little secret. And the dirty little secret is, Republicans want to spend as money just as much as the Democrats do. And when they get together, when we get to an impasse and can't figure out what to do, the only thing we agree on is spending more money. And because we can't agree to raise taxes, we just put it toward the debt. And this is actually what happened on Boehner's last day at work. The day before, you know, he handed over the gavel to Paul Ryan, he passed a deal that busted the budget caps and added $100 billion over 2 years to our spending. It was an even Steven deal worked out with Obama. $50 billion went to domestic, you know, social programs, and $50 billion went to the military. And so what's going on in Congress right now, we haven't passed a budget. Some of us have said, well, that was Boehner's deal. And the problem is Boehner did it for 2 years, and that year's already gone. And if he's not here, why are we sticking to Boehner's deal? Why do we have to spend all that money? So that's where what's happened right now in Congress. You wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know every week we're up there like at an impasse over the budget in these meetings because we have all these weapons of mass distraction. You know, it's Puerto Rico, and then it's the Zika virus, and then, you know, so we're talking about all those things, and we're naming post offices to stay busy. I mean, you'd think that's an apocryphal, you know, stereotype. It is absolutely true. Half the bills in the last 3 months have been renaming courthouses and post offices and whatnot. So, but that's what's going on right now in Congress, and it's extremely frustrating. But that's Washington's dirty little secret: is the Republicans, the majority of Republicans, or the Republicans who are in charge, want to spend as much money as the Democrats do. And here's the essence of the disconnect that I see. When I came to Congress 3.5 years ago, every week we had the GOP conference meeting. This is a room where you shut the doors, no staff comes in, no media comes in. You're not supposed to talk about what happens in the meeting. And the speaker and the leader, they call the play. And then you've got your 1 minute. Everybody gets a minute at the microphone to complain about the plan and to come up with alternate ideas. But it's all pretty much staged. You know, they already know what's going to come out of that meeting. And it's somewhat orchestrated. But here's the disconnect. When I showed up in Congress 3.5 years ago, John Boehner and Eric Cantor ran that meeting. Now, we still have those meetings every week. On the day after fly-in day, we all get in the basement of building HC5, the Republicans, and we have that meeting. But John Boehner and Eric Cantor aren't there. And so there's a certain sadness they're not there. There's like a hole in the meeting with them not being there. But nobody talks about why they're not there. It's like, oh, he must have got hit by lightning. Or He should have waited for that crosswalk sign. You know, it's like nothing they did, nothing we've been doing in that room had any consequence to their departure, but it absolutely did. And D.C. is still disconnected. We've had two chairmen in these primaries, chairmen of powerful committees, that just barely won their reelection in the primary by 1%. I mean, this is the equivalent of generals walking through battle and coming out, and there's bullet holes through their uniforms. I mean, and they're still marching on to the omnibus, you know. It's like, that's what we're still going to do. At the end of the year, I guarantee you, well, at the end of this fiscal year, it ends in September, we're going to do a CR. That's basically the proverbial can kick, where you kick the can because, oh my gosh, the elections are coming up, and nobody wants to do anything, so let's just cut, copy, paste last year's budget. It worked out so great. And then they do a CR, and typically they do it into December, the day before we go home for Christmas. And they come into that meeting, that room, HC5, with the leadership calling the playbook, and they tell us, if you vote for this omnibus, by the way, we're going to let you see it for about 24 hours, and it's 2,000 pages. If you vote for this omnibus, you all can go home for Christmas. If you don't vote for this omnibus, you're going to stay here with Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi for Christmas and New Year's. You want to see Republicans hit the yes button. That is motivating. And that's what happens at the end of every year. It's like I saw that play 3 years in a row. It's like the Groundhog Day. And you wake up and you're like, how can we change the outcome? And it's like we succeeded in one regard. We got rid of John Boehner. I mean, there were literally five of us that led that effort. Now, five of us don't have that kind of power. What we did is we discovered a parliamentary way to make our colleagues accountable for his misdeeds. Like, they were going to have to reassert that he should be the speaker after he kicked people off their committees for not voting for him, like, which is just, talk about the non-aggression principle. I mean, we got kicked off committees. I lost my subcommittee chairmanship. I was the chairman of technology committee the first year I was in Congress. They took that away from me after 6 weeks of being in Congress and voting against Boehner. People got their fundraising opportunities taken away from them. And so we were able to, just five of us. It only took five of us. We begged and pleaded to get our colleagues to join us, and they wouldn't do it. All those guys that are taking credit for it now would not join us. And we introduced a motion to vacate the office of the speaker, which precipitated his departure very soon thereafter. But then it still feels like Groundhog Day. I mean, we got a new speaker, but we're still headed to an omnibus. What about the appropriations bills? When are we going to do those? So that's somewhat frustrating for me. What are some other things I need to tell you about? Oh, real quickly, in the House, you know, in the Senate, they call their names to vote. Have you ever heard the roll call? You never hear them call our names. There's 435 of us. So we have a voting card. It looks like a credit card. And we put it in a machine, and that's how we vote, because otherwise it would be too clumsy. And so we have about 40 of those machines distributed around the House of Representatives. Well, you know, this card doesn't belong to me. In my opinion, it belongs to 750,000 people in Kentucky. And I continuously have to remind the leadership of that when they try to tell me how to vote. But one day I took this card out at a restaurant. I thought it was my credit card. And I didn't look, and I handed it to the waitress. And there's some pretty fancy credit cards these days, so she didn't pay attention, and she started swiping it. And I could see it wasn't working, but I couldn't see what card I'd handed her. So she comes back, and my kids are wondering what's up. And I'm thinking, we're going to be washing dishes. This is embarrassing. Did Rhonda pay the credit card bill? So I demanded to know why it had been rejected. She told me my card had been rejected. And she showed me the card, and she said, sir, that card already has $19 trillion on it. Now, you may not think that happened. It really did happen. And I have actually accidentally put my credit card in the voting machine. $10 billion to Afghanistan. I can just see my wife reading the bill. When were you in Afghanistan? and where's the hydro plant you bought? Which brings me to my next point. One of the most frustrating committees I serve on is the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Okay, when I find people that major in political science, I kind of nod my head. No, that's not a science. But I say, well, why are you majoring in political science? Well, I want to get into politics. I said, well, then you should major in theater. But I serve on the Oversight and Government Reform Committee with some of the best actors in the world. Jason Chaffetz, Jim Jordan, by the way, I like these guys. Trey Gowdy. I mean, by the time I get to ask the question, there's nothing but bones and sinew on the witness table. I'm like, what am I going to ask now? They've like totally stripped them to the bones. But what I realize is nothing comes of those hearings. Like, we express our righteous indignation. I can't believe you did this. The unmitigated gall. You destroyed the tapes, the records. This is what we said to Koskinen, for instance, at the IRS. After the memo went out, that nobody, keep all your backup stuff. They immediately destroyed like 200 or 300 tapes where they keep them in West Virginia. So, but nothing ever comes of that. And so that's the frustrating thing about being on the Oversight Committee. But you do get a glimpse into the waste, fraud, and abuse that's going on in our country. And you do occasionally find an honest person. And one of these guys that recently testified, his name is John Sopko. He's a special inspector general for Afghan reconstruction. We've spent $113 billion in Afghanistan. So when people, and by the way, the whole federal highway budget is $50 billion a year. So when people tell me, oh, foreign aid is such a small portion of the budget, that's because they don't put it in the foreign aid column. It's going to be in the National Defense Authorization Act this week. I mean, they're baking it in everywhere. And so it's not, they don't call it foreign aid, but we spent $113 billion in Afghanistan. And what have we got? We've got buildings that melt the first time it rains. I mean, that's the kind of contractor standards they have. Those are the buildings we can find that were supposed to be built. We had 9 male goats. The Pentagon's paid to ship 9, now these are rare blonde goats from Italy. 9 blonde goats. They're all male. Now, I don't know how you're going to start a herd with all males. There's so many places you could go with this joke. I'm not... But I'm not going there. But they wanted... So we asked the inspector general, where are the goats? He says, I can't find the goats. I think they've been eaten. We spent $6 million sending the goats there, that ostensibly to set up a cashmere industry to replace their poppy industry. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about our failed war on drugs in Afghanistan and how ridiculous it is. Look, there's reasonable argument to say we shouldn't even be telling them what to do in Afghanistan, okay? But the reality is their federal government costs them $8 billion a year and they bring in $2 billion in taxes. Nobody will loan them the money, so we give them $6 billion a year to run the government. But we've spent $8 billion on counter-narcotics efforts in Afghanistan since we started trying to stop opium production. What do you think has happened with opium production since we spent $8 billion? So the number of poppy fields, the acreage, has grown to 500,000 acres, 500,000 acres. And the opium production has doubled. They produce 90% of the world's non-pharmaceutical opium. I was embarrassed. I'm from Kentucky. And in the oversight hearing, I had a burning question I wanted to ask, but I wouldn't ask it because I didn't want to sound stupid. And so I had the inspector general come to my office the week after the hearing. And I said, there were some questions I didn't get to ask that I wanted to ask you. I said, can you see these fields? And he said, yeah, you can see them. Every time you get up in the air, they're bright orange flowers, 500,000 acres. We see these from old satellites can see these things. And I said, well, could you spray them with Roundup? And he said, yep. I said, does that kill them? And he says, yep. And I said, why don't we spray them with Roundup? And he said, it would be far too effective. Like, literally, it would cause problems if we actually succeeded. It would tank their economy. It would piss off their government. It would piss off the narco mafia that operates there. It would cause so much problems. Yet we're still spending, you know, we spent $8 billion, and we're still going to spend billions more flying planes and doing who knows what, you know. And it's just a complete failure there. I wanted to leave time for one or two questions, so I'm going to close with this quick story. I told you that staff is policy, and this is a true story, absolutely true story. All of mine are. I have staff that can vouch for this story. So part of the disconnect is you have a lot of staff in Washington that have never been to the district you represent. So I resolved to have a retreat every year and bring the DC staff to Kentucky, to my district. Well, the first year I decided, let's do this on my farm. I have a farm. Well, I was going to roast a pig. We did roast a pig. We also ended up roasting a rattlesnake that ran out in the yard. We shot machine guns. Like, I wanted to show them really how things work if you're completely free. And but we were planning this, and I live out in the country. I told you there's only one stoplight in my town, and we live 20 miles from that town out in the middle of nowhere. And so there's no hotels, and my wife is like, where in the world are you going to put 15 of your staff? And I have four children, and they all have bunk beds. Okay, so that's eight beds. And I said, we'll give all the women beds, and then the men, we have this mobile home on our farm that deer hunters stay in, so it's got wooden bunk beds there. I said, the men will stay there. It's not going to be a co-ed experience. We don't want anything, you know, any stories to get back to Washington. So my daughter, my nine-year-old daughter, heard me planning the accommodations, and she walks out. She's better than the NSA. She doesn't need my metadata. She's got the data. She walks out and puts her hand on her hip. And she said, Dad, did you say you're going to make me sleep on the floor and you're kicking me out of my room for these strangers that I have never met? And I said, just pretend it's like a camping trip. You know, we'll set a sleeping bag up in the dining room and it'll be fun. And she said, but no, Dad, what you're really telling me is you're letting government get in my bedroom. Right? Thank you. I've got to do a webinar at 8 so I can take one question, or one or two. So does anybody have a question about Congress, The Walking Dead? Yes.
How much better is Paul Ryan than John Boehner?
Okay, that's a good question. In my business, we had a saying, never confuse activity with progress, okay? And the other thing is, you know, I'm going to judge on the results. And so we're in a honeymoon period right now. I can say this. He's not kicked anybody off a committee yet. He's not done some of the vindictive things that John Boehner did. So I give him credit for that. But the real proof is going to be in the pudding. And if we end up with an omnibus at the same number that John Boehner gave us when he left, then Paul Ryan gets an F-. And if he can get appropriations bills on the floor and we get a chance to debate them in the full daylight and a chance to read the bills, then, you know, there's 12 appropriations bills. If he can do all 12, I'll give him an A. If he can do 6, I'll give him a B. Like, there's a sliding scale here. But I'm afraid he's headed for an F-.
One more question.
Okay.
Is the Senate any better than the House?
Is the Senate any better than the House? Well, here's one, like, I don't want to leave you totally pessimistic. The House is, I'm not a member of the Freedom Caucus. I am a member of the Liberty Caucus. No, you got it right. The Liberty Caucus is the residual of Rand Paul, and Justin Amash runs that. The Freedom Caucus is a voting block. Where people band together and vote the same way. They said, we need a voting block of 40. I said, you only need 39. I don't need to come to your meetings. I don't need to join the voting block. I will do the right thing. And after you've debated it for 20 or 40 hours, and you decide to do the right thing, I'll already be here doing it. So that's why I'm not in the voting block, but I am a member of the Liberty Caucus. But the good news is, what you know, the net of that is there are 40 people in the House of Representatives that are ready to take a stand. And so that's the good news. I mean, it used to just be Ron Paul. And sometimes, you know, there was a foreign aid bill. They tried to go by a voice vote just a couple weeks ago. I ran to the floor and demanded a recorded vote. Any member can do that. Willing to be the only no vote, but there were 33 no votes that said, this is ridiculous. $1 billion on a voice vote to, you know, for foreign aid, and it doesn't even name the countries it's going to. It's a slush fund for the president. And the people I said that to, they're like, but it's over 4 years, so it's really a slush fund for the next president, not Obama. But anyways, the good news is there are 30 or 40 on any given day. In the Senate, you know, you have, on a bad day, you got one, like Rand Paul, who stood up against the Patriot Act and the ill-labeled Freedom Act. He was the only one that did that. On a good day, you got four or five in the Senate. But here's one thing I do want to tell you about the difference in the Senate and the House. You were told, if you give Republicans a majority in the House, you know, we can stop Obama. You were told, if you give us the majority in the Senate, we can stop Obama. Now you're being told, we need 60 votes or we need to change the 60-vote rule. That is hogwash. It's totally hogwash. Because it takes 60 votes to pass things in the Senate. So if you decide not to fund something in the Senate, it requires only 40 people willing to stand up to stop the funding from going to the White House. So that's the difference between the House and the Senate. That's the little lie that you're being told about the Senate rules need to change. The Senate rules do not need to change. Trust me, the 60-vote rule helps the minority. And the last time I checked, we're in a desperately small minority in the Senate. On a good day, it's 5. But so we need to keep the 60-vote rule, and we need to use the math to our advantage. And I've got to run. So thank you very much.